Most blocked creatives have an addiction to anxiety. We prefer the low-grade pain and occasional heart-stopping panic attack to the drudgery of small and simple daily steps in the right direction. Filling the form means that we must work with what we have rather than languish in complaints over what we have not. So, take one small daily action instead of indulging in the big questions. When we allow ourselves to wallow in the big questions, we fail to find the small answers. Instead of doing that, make changes, small changes, right where you are. Large changes occur in tiny increments. It's useful to think in terms of a space flight. By altering the launch trajectory ever so slightly, a great difference can be made over time. We're going to circle back now and do yet another exercise to add some more pieces to the mosaic you're making of your life. We call this exercise early patternings because, although we seldom connect the dots, many of our present-day losses are connected to our earlier conditioning. Children may be told they can't do anything, or, equally damaging, be told they should be able to do absolutely anything with ease. Either of these messages blocks the recipient. The following phrases are aimed at helping you retrieve and decipher your own conditioning. Listen and associate. You may wish to make some notes on paper. As a kid, my dad thought my art was... As a kid, my mother taught me that my daydreaming was... The person I remember who believed in me was... I grew up thinking artists were... blank... kind of people. As we've said before, anger is a map. It points us the direction we want to go. But it's easy to become stuck in our anger. And so the exercise which follows now is an exercise of transformation. We will be using affirmations. The following affirmations affirm your right to the practice of your creativity in the present, no matter what the pitfalls were of your past. I am a talented, creative person. I have a right to be an artist. I now treat myself and my creativity more gently. I now share my creativity more openly. I now accept God's help in unfolding my creative gifts. I now believe God loves artists. I now believe God loves artists like myself. That's it for week 8. Let's move on to tasks. But before we do, I would like to acknowledge a few teachers whose thinking has been seminal to my own. Barbara Scher, Shakti Gawain, Sonia Choquette, Sark, Natalie Goldberg. The following tasks reflect the wisdom of all these teachers. Let's work with them now. 1. Name your dream. Write it down. Choose one concrete landmark that signals to you its accomplishment. Call that landmark True North. Find it on your inner compass. Always look to that landmark to know if you're moving in the right direction. Ask yourself, what action can you take this year to move you closer? Then ask, what action can you take this month, this week, this day, right now? Always check your landmark to know you're moving true north in the right direction. Remember that even one small step in the direction of your dream is a start. Now, examine your dream more closely. Look again at the landmark that signals its true north. Select for yourself a role model, someone who has accomplished your dream. Now, make an action plan. Imagine this role model as your mentor. What might the model tell you to do in 5 years, in 3 years, in 1 year, in 1 month? In 1 week, right now. Choose an action. Begin. Number 2. New childhood. What might you have been if you'd had perfect nurturing? Write a page of this fantasy, or meditate about it on a 5-minute walk. Number 3. Plan a perfect day in your life as it is currently constituted. Number 4. Plan a perfect day in your life as you wish it were constituted. Number 5. Choose one festive aspect from your perfect day. Allow yourself to live it fully in your imagination. Number 6. Choose one festive aspect from your perfect day and allow yourself to live it fully in your life. Week 9, Recovering a Sense of Compassion. One of the most important tasks in artistic recovery is learning to call things and ourselves by the right names. For example, blocked artists are not lazy. They're blocked. Being blocked and being lazy are two different things. The blocked artist typically expends a great deal of energy, just not visibly. The blocked artist spends energy on self-hatred, on regret, on grief, and on jealousy. The blocked artist spends energy on self-doubt. Do not call the inability to start laziness. Call it fear. Fear is the true name for what ails the blocked artist. It may be fear of failure or fear of success. Most frequently, it's fear of abandonment. This fear has roots in childhood reality. Many artists try to become artists against their parents' good wishes or their parents' good judgment. This creates a guilt which demands that they set a goal for themselves, that they be great artists in order to justify being artists at all. The need to be a great artist makes it hard to be an artist. The need to produce a great work of art makes it hard to produce any art at all. Finding it hard to begin a project, however, does not mean you will not be able to do it. What it does mean is that you will need help from your higher power, from supportive friends, and, above all, from yourself. First of all, you must give yourself permission to begin small and go in baby steps. These steps must be rewarded. Setting impossible goals creates enormous fear, which creates procrastination, which we wrongly call laziness. Don't call procrastination laziness. Call it fear. The antidote is a baby step. Always remember, fear is what blocks an artist. There is only one cure for fear, and that cure is love. So use love for your artist to cure its fear. Stop yelling at yourself. Be nice. Call fear by its right name, and you will coax a baby step forward. Let's look now at another toxic idea. It must take so much discipline to be an artist, we are often told by well-meaning people who are not artists but wish that they were. As artists, grounding our self-image in military discipline is dangerous. In the short run, discipline may work, but it will only work for a while. That part of us that creates best is not a driven, disciplined automaton functioning from self-will with a booster of pride to back it up. This is operating out of self-will. You know the image. Rising at dawn with military precision, the artist salutes the desk, the easel, the drawing board. Well, over any extended period of time, being an artist requires enthusiasm more than discipline. Enthusiasm is not an emotional state. It is a spiritual commitment. Enthusiasm, from the Greek, filled with God, is an ongoing energy supply tapped into the flow of life itself. Enthusiasm is grounded play, not work. True, our artist may rise at dawn to greet the typewriter or the easel in the morning stillness. But this event has more to do with the child's love of secret adventure than with ironclad discipline. Our artist child can best be enticed to work by treating work as play. Paint is great gooey stuff. 60 sharpened pencils are fun. In order to work well, many artists find that their workspaces are best dealt with as play spaces. Dinosaur murals, toys from the five and dime, tiny miniature Christmas lights, papier-mâché monsters, hanging crystals, a sprig of flowers, a fish tank. As attractive as the idea of a pristine cell, monastic in its severity, is to our romanticized notion of being a real artist, the workable truth may be somewhat messier than that. Kids would be bored silly in a stark, barren room, and our artist child is no exception. Remember, art is process. The process is supposed to be fun. For our purposes, the journey is always the only arrival may be interpreted to mean that our creative work is actually our creativity itself at play in the field of time. At the heart of this play is the mystery of joy. It is one of the paradoxes of creative recovery that joy is often found on the far side of grief. And so we turn now to a topic that is painful, some of the grief and wounding that may block our joy. We're going to look at creative U-turns. Recovering from artist's block, like recovering from any major illness or injury, requires a commitment to health. At some point, we must make an active choice to relinquish the joys and privileges accorded to the emotional invalid. A productive artist is often a happy person. This can be very threatening as a self-concept to those who are used to getting their needs met by being unhappy. Many recovering artists become so threatened that they make U-turns and sabotage themselves. We usually commit creative harikari either on the eve of or in the wake of a first creative victory. We're more comfortable being a victim of artist block than risking having to be consistently productive and healthy. For example, a screenwriter has an agent interested in repping a script with just a few changes. He doesn't make the changes. An actor is told to get his headshots together and check back in with a prestigious agent. He doesn't get his headshots and he doesn't check back in. Typically, when we take a creative U-turn, we are doubly shamed. First by our fear and second by our reaction to it. Let me say it helps to remember that all careers have them. So it happens to the best of us. Have compassion. Creative U-turns are always born from fear. Fear of success or fear of failure. It doesn't really matter which, the net result is the same. To recover from a creative U-turn or a pattern involving many creative U-turns, we must first admit that it exists. Yes, I did react negatively to fear or to pain. Yes, I did retreat. Yes, I do need help. First of all, take a look at what jumps make your horse so skittish. You may find that certain obstacles are far more scary to you than others. An agent jump may frighten you more than a workshop jump. A review jump may be okay, but a rewrite jump may scare your talent to death. One trick a seasoned jockey uses is to place a green horse in the slipstream of an older, steadier, and more seasoned horse. You can do that, too. Think of your talent as that green horse. Look for a more seasoned veteran to point the way. You might ask, "Who do I know who has an agent?" And ask that person how he got one. You might ask, "Who do I know who's done a successful rewrite?" And ask that person how to do one. Once we admit the need for help, the help arrives. The ego always wants to claim self-sufficiency. It would rather pose as a creative loner than ask for help. Ask anyway. Faced with a creative U-turn, ask yourself, "Who can I ask for help about this U-turn?" Then start asking. Accustomed as we are to the therapist's way and not the artist's way, We often interpret mere creative resistance as severe neurosis. Instead, let's work with a creative tool that blasts through blocks. In order to work freely on a project, an artist must be at least functionally free of resentment and resistance. What do we mean by that? We mean that any buried barriers must be aired before the work can proceed. Remember, your artist is a creative child, and it sulks, throws tantrums, holds grudges, and harbors irrational fears. Beginning any new project, it's a good idea to ask your artist a few simple questions. These questions will help remove common bugaboos standing between your artist and its work. These same questions, asked again when work grows difficult or bogs down, usually act to clear the obstructed flow. First, list any resentments, angers, that you may have in connection with this project. It doesn't matter how petty, picky, or irrational these resentments may appear. To the artist child, they are real big deals, grudges. I resent being the second artist asked, not the first. I resent doing work for this idiot. He never pays me on time. That kind of thing. Next, ask your artist to list any and all fears about the projected piece of work and/or anybody connected to it. Again, these fears can be as dumb as any two-year-old's. What matters is that they are big, scary monsters to your artist. Things like, I'm afraid the work will be rotten and I won't know it. I'm afraid the work will be good and they won't know it. That sort of thing. After that, ask yourself if that's all. Have you left out any itsy fear? Have you suppressed any stupid anger? Get it on the page. Then, ask yourself what you stand to gain by not doing this piece of work. Some examples. If I don't write the piece, nobody can hate it. If I don't write the piece, my jerk editor will worry and I'd love it. If I don't paint, sculpt, act, sing, dance, I can criticize others knowing I could do better. All right, finally, make your deal. And the deal is, okay, creative force, you take care of the quality. I'll take care of the quantity. Post that as a sign. Put it in your work area. But a word of warning, this is a very powerful exercise. It can do fatal damage to creative resistance. That's it for week 9. Now, let's take a look at our tasks. Brace yourself. Number 1, read your morning pages. That's right. Take stock, take heart, and acknowledge yourself. Read them as if you are your own best friend. Number 2, visualize. Name your goal. I am writing a novel. I am directing. I am painting freely. In the present tense, describe yourself doing your goal at the height of your powers. This is what you might call your ideal scene. Read this scene aloud to yourself. Post this scene written out above your work area. Read it out loud once daily. Every day this week, collect actual pictures of yourself and combine them with magazine images to collage your ideal scene as you've described it. Remember that seeing is believing, and that the added visual cue of your real self in your ideal scene can make it seem far more real. Number 3, prioritize. List for yourself your creative goals for the year, then for the month, then for the week. Do one thing today. Number 4, creative U-turns. All of us have taken creative U-turns. Name 3. Name the one that just kills you. Then, forgive yourself. Forgive yourself for all failures of nerve, timing, and initiative. Next, very, very gently consider whether any aborted, abandoned, savaged, or sabotaged brain children can be rescued. Next, Choose one creative U-turn. Retrieve it and mend it. Remember, don't take a creative U-turn now. Instead, notice your resistance. Are your morning pages seeming difficult? Do them anyway. What creative dreams are lurching now toward possibility? Just admit that they frighten you and keep moving. 5. Choose for yourself an artist totem. It might be a doll or a stuffed animal, a carved figurine, or a wind-up toy. The point is to pick something you immediately feel a protective fondness toward. Give your totem a place of honor, and then honor it by not beating up on your artist child. Week 10, Recovering a Sense of Self-Protection. Creativity is God energy flowing through us, shaped by us, like light flowing through a crystal prism. When we're clear about who we are and what we're doing, the energy flows freely and we experience no strain. When we resist what that energy might show us or where it might take us, we often experience a shaky, out-of-control feeling. We want to shut down the flow and regain our sense of control. We slam on the psychic brakes. We block. Every creative person has myriad ways to block creativity. Each of us favors one or two ways particularly toxic to us because they block us so effectively. For some people, food is a creativity issue. Eating sugar or fats or certain carbohydrates may leave them feeling dulled, hungover, unable to focus, blurry. They use food to block energy and change. As the shaky feeling comes over them that they are going too fast and God knows where, that they are about to fly apart, these people reach for food, a big bowl of ice cream, an evening of junk food, and their system clogs. What was I thinking? What? Oh, never mind. For some people, alcohol is the favored block. For others, drugs. For many, work is the block of choice. Busy, 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 they grab for tasks to numb themselves with. For others, an obsession with painful love places creative choice outside their hands. Reaching for the painful thought, they become instant victims rather than feel their own considerable power. If only he or she would just love me. This obsessive thought drowns out the little voice that suggests rearranging the living room, taking a pottery class, trying a new top on that short story that's stymied. Sex is the great block for many. A mesmerizing, titillating, hypnotic interest slides novel erotic possibilities in front of the real novel. Now, note carefully that food, work, and sex are all good in themselves. It's the abuse of them that makes them creativity issues. Knowing yourself as an artist means acknowledging which of these you abuse when you want to block yourself. Line up your possible blocks. Which one makes you angry to even think about giving up? That explosive one is the one that has caused you the most derailment. Examine it. When asked to name our poison, most of us can. Has food sabotaged you? Has workaholism sabotaged you? Has sex or love obsession blocked your creativity? We turn to our drug of choice to block our creativity whenever we experience the anxiety of our inner emptiness. We experience it as a void, not as potential. And so it is always fear, often disguised but always there, that leads us into grabbing for a block. It takes grace and courage to admit and surrender our blocking devices. Who wants to? Not while they're still working. As we become more aware of our blocking devices, the blocks will no longer work effectively. Over time, we will try, perhaps slowly at first and erratically, to ride out the anxiety and see where we emerge. Feel anxious. Try using the anxiety. Feel, I just did it. I didn't block. I used the anxiety as fuel and moved ahead. Oh, my God. I am excited. I'd like to take a look now at a block which we seldom see as a block. This is workaholism. Workaholism is an addiction, And like all addictions, it blocks creative energy. In fact, it could be argued that the desire to block the fierce flow of creative energy is an underlying reason for all addictions. Only recently recognized as addiction, workaholism still receives a great deal of support in our society. The phrase, "I'm working," has a certain unassailable air of goodness and duty to it. In creative recovery, it's far easier to get people to do the extra work of the morning pages than it is to get them to do the assigned play of an artist date. "If I had more time, I'd have more fun," we like to tell ourselves, but this is seldom the truth. To test the validity of this assertion, ask yourself how much time you allot each week to fun, pure, unadulterated, non-productive fun. "I may have a small problem with overwork," we like to tell ourselves, "but I'm not really a workaholic." Try listening to these questions before you're so sure. Do you work outside of office hours? Do you cancel dates with loved ones to do more work? Do you postpone outings until the deadline is over? Do you take work with you on weekends? Do your intimates complain that you always work? Do you try to do two things at once? Do you allow yourself free time between projects? Do you place your creative dreams before your work? Do you allow yourself downtime to do nothing? Do you use the word deadline to describe and rationalize your workload? One way to achieve clarity about our time expenditure is to keep a daily checklist and record our time spent. Even an hour of creative play can go a long way toward offsetting the sense of workaholic desperation that keeps our dreams at bay. Because workaholism is a process addiction, an addiction to a behavior rather than a substance, it's difficult to tell when we're indulging in it. One very simple but effective way to check your own recovery progress is to post a sign in your work area. The sign should read, "Workaholism is a block, not a building block." Workaholism is deadening, so deadening that it often brings on a drought. In any creative life, there are dry seasons. Life loses its sweetness, our work feels mechanical. These are the times when the morning pages are most difficult and most valuable. During a drought, doubts sidle up to us like sidewinders. "What's the use?" they hiss. Droughts tell us that they will last forever and that we will not. During a drought, the morning pages seem both painful and foolish. They feel like empty gestures, like making breakfast for the lover we know is leaving us anyhow. Hoping against hope that we'll someday be creative again, we go through the motions. Our consciousness is parched. We cannot feel so much as a trickle of grace. During a drought, we're fighting with God. We've lost faith in the great Creator and in our creative selves. This is the desert of the heart. Looking for a hopeful sign, all we see are the hulking remains of the dreams that have died along the path. During a drought, emotions are dried up. Like water, they may exist somewhere underneath, but we have no access to them. A drought is a tearless time of grief. We are between dreams. Droughts are terrible. Droughts hurt. Droughts are long, airless seasons of doubt that make us grow, give us compassion, and blossom as unexpectedly as the desert with sudden flowers. Droughts do end. In a creative life, droughts are a necessity. The time in the desert brings us clarity and charity. When you are in a drought, know that it is to a purpose, and keep writing morning pages. To write is to write things. Sooner or later, always later than we like, our pages will bring things right, a path will emerge, an insight will be a landmark that shows the way out of the wilderness. You pick up a magazine, or even your alumni news, and somebody you know, has gone further, faster, toward your dream. Instead of saying, That proves it can be done. Your fear will say, he or she succeeded instead of me. This brings us to competition. When we are ogling the accomplishments of others, we take our eye away from our own through line. Why do I have such rotten luck? Why did he get his movie article play out before I got mine out? Questions like these allow us to ignore the more useful questions. Did I work on my play today? Did I make the deadline to mail it off where it needed to go? These are the real questions, and focusing on them can be hard for us. No wonder it's tempting to take the first emotional drink instead. As artists, we cannot afford to think about who's getting ahead of us and how they don't deserve it. The desire to be better than can choke off the simple desire to be. As artists, we cannot afford this thinking. It leads us away from our own voices and choices and into a defensive game that centers outside of ourselves and our sphere of influence. This compare and contrast school of thinking may have its place for critics, but not for artists in the act of creation. Let the critics spot trends. Let reviewers concern themselves with what's in and what's not. Let us concern ourselves first and foremost with what is within us that is struggling to be born. When we compete with others, this is the sprint mentality. Looking for the short-term win, ignoring the long-term gain, we short-circuit the possibility of a creative life led by our own lights, not the Klieg lights of fashion. Whenever you're angered about someone else beating you out, remember this. The foot race mentality is always the ego's demand to be not just good, but also first and best. It is the ego's demand that our work be totally original, as if such a thing were possible. All work is influenced by other work. All people are influenced by other people. No man is an island, and no piece of art is a continent unto itself. We seldom see a new. Instead, we see an old in a new light. If the demand to be original still troubles you, remember this. Each of us is our own country, an interesting place to visit. It is the accurate mapping out of our own creative interests that invites the term original. We are the origin of our art, its homeland. Viewed this way, originality is the process of remaining true to ourselves. The spirit of competition urges us to quickly winnow out whatever doesn't seem like a winning idea. This can be very dangerous. It can interfere with our ability to carry a project to term. The need to win now is a need to win approval from others. As an antidote, we must learn to approve of ourselves. Showing up for the work is the win that matters. That's it for week 10. Now let's move on to the tasks. This week we've got some whoppers. First, the deadlies. Take a piece of paper and cut 7 small strips from it. On each strip, write one of the following words: alcohol, drugs, sex, work, money, food, family, friends. Fold these strips of paper and place them in an envelope. Now draw a slip from the envelope and write 5 ways in which it has had a negative impact on your life. Please draw 7 times. Yes, you may draw the same deadly repeatedly. Yes, this is significant. 2. The awful truth. Tell the truth. What habit do you have that gets in the way of your creativity? 3. Touchstones. Make a quick list of things you love, happiness touchstones for you. Put at least 10 items on it and post this list where it can console you and remind you of your own personal touchstones. Number 4, cherishing. List 5 small victories. Number 5, do one lovely thing for yourself each day this week. Week 11, Recovering a Sense of Autonomy. I am an artist. As an artist, I may need a different mix of stability and flow from other people. I may find that a 9-to-5 job steadies me and leaves me freer to create, or I may find that a 9-to-5 drains me of energy and leaves me unable to create. I must experiment with what works for me, and I must accept it. Being true to the inner artist often results in work that sells, but not always. I have to free myself from determining my value and the value of my work by my work's current market value. The idea that money validates my credibility is very hard to shake. I must learn that as an artist, my credibility lies with me, God, and my work. In other words, if I have a poem to write, I need to write that poem, whether it'll sell or not. I need to create what wants to be created. I cannot plan a career to unfold in a sensible direction dictated by cash flow and marketing strategies. Those things are fine, but too much attention to them can stifle the child within, who gets angry and scared when continually put off. Children, as we all know, do not deal well with later, not now. Since my artist is a child, the natural child within, I must make some concessions to its sense of timing. Some concessions does not mean total irresponsibility. What it means is letting the artist have quality time, knowing that if I let it do what it wants to do, it will cooperate with me in doing what I need to do. Sometimes I'll write badly, draw badly, paint badly, perform badly. I've got a right to do that to get to the other side. Creativity is its own reward. As an artist, I must be very careful to surround myself with people who nurture my artist, not people who try to overly domesticate it for my own good. Certain friendships will kick off my artistic imagination, and others will deaden it. To a large degree, my life is my art, and when it gets dull, so does my work. As an artist, I may poke into what other people think of as dead ends. A punk band that I mysteriously fall for, a piece of gospel music that hooks my inner ear, a piece of red silk I just like and add to a nice outfit, thereby ruining it. As an artist, I may frizz my hair like Bernadette Peters or wear it sleek as Meryl Streep. As an artist, I may spend too much money on perfume in a pretty blue bottle, even though the perfume stinks, because the bottle lets me write about Paris in the 30s. As an artist, my self-respect comes from doing the work. One performance at a time, one gig at a time, one painting at a time. Throughout it all, daily, I show up at the morning pages and I write about my ugly curtains, my rotten haircut, my delight in the way the light hit the trees on the morning run. As an artist, I do not need to be rich, but I need to be richly supported. I cannot allow my emotional and intellectual life to stagnate, or the work will show it. As an artist, I can literally die from boredom. I kill myself when I fail to nurture my artist child because I'm acting like somebody else's idea of a grown-up. The more I nurture my artist child, the more adult I am able to appear. Spoiling my artist means it will let me type a business letter. Ignoring my artist means a grinding depression. Creativity is oxygen for our souls. Cutting off our creativity makes us savage. We react like we're being choked. When well-meaning parents and friends push marriage or 9-to-5 or anything on us that doesn't evolve in a way that allows for our art to continue, we might react as if we're fighting for our lives. We are. If you are happier writing than not writing, painting than not painting, singing than not singing, acting than not acting, directing than not directing, for God's sake, and I mean that literally, let yourself do it. To kill your dreams because they are irresponsible is to be irresponsible to yourself. Credibility lies with you and God, not with the vote of your friends and acquaintances. The Creator made us creative. Our creativity is our gift from God. Our use of it is our gift to God. Accepting this bargain is the beginning of true self-acceptance. Let's talk for a minute about what constitutes true success. Creativity is a spiritual practice. It's not something that can be perfected, finished, and set aside. It is my experience that we reach plateaus of creative attainment only to have a certain restlessness set in. Yes, we are successful. Yes, we've made it, but... In other words, just when we get there disappears. This unfinished quality, this restless appetite for further exploration, tests us. We are asked to expand in order that we not contract. As artists, we are spiritual sharks. The ruthless truth is that if we don't keep moving, we sink to the bottom and die. The choice is very simple. We can insist on resting on our laurels, or we can begin again. It is this willingness to once more be a beginner that distinguishes a creative career. As artists, we are travelers. Too heavily encumbered by our worldly dignity, too invested in our stations and positions, we become unable to yield to our spiritual leadings. We insist then on a straight and narrow when the artist's way is a spiral path. Invested in the outer trappings of a career, we can place that investment above our inner guidance. Creativity is not a business, although it may generate much business. An artist cannot replicate a prior success indefinitely. Those who attempt to work too long with formula, even their own formula, eventually leech themselves of their creative truths. As a successful artist, the trick is to not mortgage the future too heavily. If the house in the Hamptons costs 2 years of creative misery cranking out a promised project just for cash, that house is an expensive luxury. This is not to say that editors should stop planning seasons or that studios should scuttle their business bottom line. You don't need to overturn a successful career in order to find creative fulfillment. But it is necessary to overturn each day's schedule slightly to allow for those small adjustments in daily trajectory that over the long haul alter the course and the satisfactions of our careers. This means writing your morning pages, taking your artist date. But I run a studio, you say, or whatever thing it is you must do. People depend on me. I say, all the more reason to depend on yourself and protect your own creativity. Artists can and do responsibly meet the demands of their business partnerships. What is more difficult and more critical is for us as artists to continue to meet the inner demand of our own artistic growth. In short, as success comes to us, we must be vigilant. Any success postulated on a permanent artistic plateau dooms us and it to failure. We have been talking about creating a body of work, but for a moment, let's focus on our physical body. Most blocked creatives are cerebral beings. In order to effect a real recovery, one that lasts, we need to move out of the head and into a body of work. To do this, we must first of all move into the body. Again, this is a matter that requires acceptance. Creativity requires action, and part of that action must be physical. It is one of the pitfalls for Westerners adopting Eastern meditation techniques to bliss out and render ourselves high but dysfunctional. We lose our grounding and with it our capacity to act in the world. In the pursuit of higher consciousness, we render ourselves unconscious in a new way. Exercise combats this spiritually induced dysfunction. Returning to the notion of ourselves as spiritual radio sets, we need enough energy to raise a strong signal. This is where walking comes in. What we are after here is a moving meditation. The goal is to connect to a world outside of ourselves. To lose the obsessive self-focus and self-exploration and simply explore. One quickly notes that when the mind is focused on other, the self often comes into a far more accurate focus. Exercise teaches us the rewards of process. It teaches the sense of satisfaction over small tasks well done. Exercise seems to call it forth in other circumstances when we mistrust our personal strength. Rather than scotch a creative project which frustrates us, we learn to move through the difficulty. Life is a series of hurdles, says my sister Libby, a painter whose sport is horseback riding. I used to see it as a series of obstacles or roadblocks. Now they're hurdles and challenges. How well am I taking them, I ask. In the daily schooling of her horse, teaching her to think before she jumps, to pace herself properly, Libby has learned the same skills for her own life. Part of this learned creative patience has to do with connecting to a sense of universal creativity. When you ride through a field of grass and little flecks of fluff from the wheat ears float around you, the feeling makes your heart sing. It's not only the sense of a communion with nature that creates a singing in the heart. An endorphin-induced natural high is one of the byproducts of exercise itself. A runner may feel the same celebratory sense of well-being pounding a dirty city street. Exercise is often the going that moves us from stagnation to inspiration, from problem to solution, from self-pity to self-respect. We do learn by going. Exercise, the act of bringing into play or realizing in action, says Webster's Ninth. W.H. Auden has remarked that art's only concern is with the sacred. That brings us to building your artist's altar. Morning pages are meditation, a practice that brings you to your creativity and your creative God. In order to stay easily and happily creative, we need to stay spiritually centered. This is easier to do if we allow ourselves centering rituals. A spiritual room or even a spiritual corner is an excellent way to do this. This haven can be one small corner of a room, a nook under the stairs, even a window ledge. But an artist's altar should be a sensory experience. Small rituals, self-devised, are good for the soul. Burning incense while reading affirmations or writing them, lighting a candle, dancing to drum music, holding a smooth rock and listening to Gregorian chant. All of these tactile physical techniques reinforce spiritual growth. Remember, the artist child speaks the language of the soul. Music, dance, scent, shells. Make an artist's altar for yourself. Your artist's altar to the Creator should be fun to look at, even silly. Remember how much kids like gaudy stuff? Your artist is a little kid. So, let your imagination play. That's it for week 11. Now let's take a look at our tasks. 1. Tape your own voice reading the basic principles. Use this tape for meditation. 2. Write out in longhand your artist's prayer. Place it in your wallet. 3. Buy yourself a special creativity notebook. Number pages 1 through 7. Give one page each to the following categories: health, possessions, leisure, relationships, creativity, career, and spirituality. List 10 wishes in each area on the proper page. Let yourself dream a little here. 4. Inventory for yourself the ways you have changed since beginning your recovery. 5. List 5 ways you plan to nurture yourself in the next 6 months, courses you will take, supplies you will allow yourself, artist dates you'll execute. List 10 examples of personal synchronicity that support the possibility of a nurturing creative force. Week 12, Recovering a Sense of Faith. Mickey Hart says, "Adventures don't begin until you get into the forest. That first step is an act of faith." He's right about that. Each of us has an inner dream that we can unfold if we will just have the courage to admit what it is, and the faith to trust our own admission. The admitting is often very difficult. A clearing affirmation can often open the channel. One excellent one is, "I know the things I know." It's just that we're not accustomed to thinking that God's will for us and our own inner dreams can coincide. Instead, we have bought the message of our culture. This world is a veil of tears, and we are meant to be dutiful and then die. The truth is that we are meant to be bountiful and live. The universe will always support affirmative action. Our truest dream for ourself is always God's will for us. The late great mythologist Joseph Campbell wrote, "Follow your bliss and doors will open where there were no doors before." It is the inner commitment to be true to ourselves and follow our dreams that triggers the support of the universe. While we are ambivalent, the universe will seem to us also to be ambivalent. The flow through our lives will be characterized by spurts of abundance and long spells of drought when our supply dwindles to a mere trickle. If we look back at the times when the world seemed to be a capricious and untrustworthy place, we will see that we were ourselves conflicted in our goals and behaviors. There is a path for each of us. When we are on our right path, we have a sure-footedness. We know the next right action, although not necessarily what's just around the bend. By trusting, we learn to trust. This brings us to a mystery. Creativity, like human life itself, begins in darkness. We need to acknowledge this. All too often we think only in terms of light. We say, "And then the light bulb went on and I got it." It's true that insights may come to us as flashes. It's true that some of these flashes may be blinding. It is, however, also true that such bright ideas are preceded by a gestation period that is interior, murky, and completely necessary. Mystery is at the heart of creativity. All too often, when we say we want to be creative, we mean that we want to be consistently creative, like machines. As creative channels, we need to trust the darkness. We need to learn to gently mull instead of churning away like a little engine on a straight-ahead path. This mulling on the page can be very threatening. "I'll never get any real ideas this way," we fret. Hatching an idea is a lot like baking bread. Open that oven too soon and the bread collapses, or the cake gets a hole in its middle because all the steam is rushed out of it. Creativity requires a respectful reticence. The truth is that this is how to raise the best ideas. Let them grow in dark and mystery. Let them form on the roof of our consciousness. Let them hit the page in droplets. Trusting this slow and seemingly random drip, we will be startled one day by the flash of, "Oh, that's it." When we think about creativity, it's all too easy to think art with a capital A. For our purposes, capital A art is a scarlet letter. In order to nurture our creativity, we require a sense of festivity, even humor. "Art, that's somebody my sister used to date." We are talking about the imagination at play. Yet, we are an ambitious society, and it's often difficult for us to cultivate forms of creativity that do not directly serve us and our career goals. Recovery urges our re-examining our definitions of creativity and expanding them to include what in the past we called hobbies. The experience of creative living argues that hobbies are in fact essential to a joyful life. Many hobbies involve a form of artist brain mulling that leads to enormous creative breakthroughs. When I'm stuck at the midpoint of Act 2 on a play or a screenplay, I do household mending. When someone is panicked halfway across the bridge into a new life, Repotting plants into larger and better containers quite literally grounds that person and gives him or her a sense of expansion. Spiritual benefits accompany the practice of a hobby. There is a release into humility that comes from doing something just for love. As we serve our hobby, we are freed from our ego's demands and allowed the experience of merging with greater sources. This conscious contact frequently affords us the perspective needed to solve vexing personal or creative conundrums. It's a paradox of creative recovery that we must get serious about taking ourselves lightly. We must work at learning to play. Creativity must be freed from the narrow parameters of capital A art and recognized as having much broader play. That word again. As we work with our morning pages and artist dates, many forgotten samplings of our own creativity often come to mind. We discover anew that we are creative beings. The impulse cooks in us all, simmering along all the time. Without our knowledge, without our encouragement, even without our approval, it moves beneath the surface of our lives like new grass under snow. We are intended to create. As gray, as controlled, as dreamless as we may strive to be, the fire of our dreams will not stay buried. The embers are always there, stirring in our frozen souls. Restive in our lives, we yearn for more, we wish, we chafe. We sing in the car, slam down the phone, make lists, clear closets, sort through shelves. We want to do something, but we think it needs to be the right something, by which we mean something important. But we're what's important, and the something that we do can be something festive but small. The dead plants go. The mismatched socks bite the dust. Who bought that azalea? Why the sudden taste for pink? Is the picture you've tacked up a you you're going toward? These are the shifts you'll feel. Your shoes are worn. You throw them out. A friend worries once too often about what's come over you, and you take your first vacation in years. You're either losing your mind or gaining your soul. Life is meant to be an artist's date. That's why we were created. There's one last thing I should mention. I call it escape velocity. My friend Michelle Lawrence has a theory born of long and entangled romantic experience. In a nutshell, it goes, when you're going to leave them, they know. This same theory applies to creative recovery. It occurs when you reach what Michelle calls escape velocity. As she puts it, there's this time for blastoff like a NASA space launch, and you're heading for it when, wham, you draw to you the test.
The test?
Yeah, the test. It's like when you're all set to marry the nice guy, the one who treats you right, and Mr. Poison gets wind of it and phones you up.
Ah.
Do we really draw to us a test? I've concluded the answer's yes. As recovering creatives, many of us find that every time our career heats up, we reach for our nearest wet blanket. We blurt out our enthusiasm to our most skeptical friend. In fact, we call him up. If we don't, he calls us. This is the test. Our artist is a child, an inner youngster, and when he's scared, mommy is what he calls for. Unfortunately, many of us have wet blanket mommies, or daddies, and a whole army of surrogate wet blankets, those friends who have our second, third, and fourth thoughts for us. The trick is to not let them be that way.
How?
Zip the lip, button up, keep a lid on it. Don't give away the gold. Always remember, the first rule of magic is containment. You must hold your intention within yourself, stoking it with power. Only then will you be able to manifest what you desire. In order to achieve escape velocity, we must learn to keep our own counsel, to move silently among doubters, to voice our plans only among our allies, and to name our allies accurately. Do not indulge or tolerate anyone who throws cold water in your direction. Forget good intentions. Forget they didn't mean it. Remember to count your blessings and your toes. Escape velocity requires the sword of steely intention and the shield of self-determination. They will try to get you. Don't forget that, warns Michelle. Set your goals. Set your boundaries.
I would add, set your sights.